Hello and welcome to our program Arts and Tech, brought to you by OWL Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center. I am Hanukkah Passi, and during the next half hour, I will be reading articles from a variety of sources here on OWL Radio. Welcome back, everyone. Hope you're doing well. Hope you are not heating up too much, still enjoying some spring weather. I have a great bunch of articles for you today. Some about technology and writing, about data, and I have one about a fun event going on in San Antonio if you're interested. All right, so let's get started. So the first article I have for you is from the New York Times, and it is, about writers, and it's about AI and how you can intersect these two things. So it's going to be really fun, I think, for us to read here. This is by Elizabeth A. Harris, and it's titled Peering into the Future of Novels with Trained Machines Ready. In a new novella, Death of an Author, the writer, Aidan Marchin, describes a subpar plate of nachos this way. The cheese was congealed and the chips soggy, damp, and smeared with a greasy film like some kind of lake scum. Gus forced himself to take a bite, but the flavor was rancid, a sickly sweet imitation of cheese. He washed it down with a swig of beer, but even that tasted ugly, like it had been sitting in the sun for too long. The writing is vivid, but there's nothing particularly unusual about it. Aidan Marchin, however, is an unusual author, at least for now, because Aidan Marchin is a set of computer systems. Kind of. The journalist and author Stephen Marsh wrote Death of an Author using three artificial intelligence programs. Or three artificial intelligence programs wrote it with extensive plotting and prompting from Stephen Marsh. It depends on how you look at it. I am the creator of this work 100%, Marsh said, but on the other hand, I didn't create the words. Pushkin Industries, an audio production company, will publish the novella next month as an audiobook and ebook. Even the moniker Marchin is an invention of a program, a combination of Marsh and machine. In January, Jacob Weisberg, Pushkin's chief executive, approached Marsh, who had been writing with and about artificial intelligence since 2017. He asked if Marsh was interested in using the technology to produce a murder mystery. The result of that collaboration is Death of an Author, in which an author who uses AI extensively winds up dead. Who done it? Was it her estranged daughter? Was it the professor of crime and cyberfiction who was an expert on her work? Was it the eccentric billionaire who worked with her on a secretive AI project? To coax the story from his laptop, Marsh used three programs starting with ChatGPT. He ran an outline of the plot through the software along with numerous prompts and notes. While AI was good at many things, especially dialogue, he said, its plots were terrible. Next, he used PseudoWrite, asking the program to make a sentence longer or shorter, to adopt a more conversational tone, or to make the writing sound like Ernest Hemingway's. Then he used Cohere to create what he called the best lines in the book. If he wanted to describe the smell of coffee, he trained the program with examples and then asked it to generate similes until he found one he liked. To me, the process was a bit akin to hip-hop, he said. If you're making hip-hop, you don't necessarily know how to drum, but you definitely need to know how beats work, how hooks work, and you need to be able to put them together in a meaningful way. Marsh says that these programs could be a tool for writers, and he declared himself optimistic about the growth of algorithmic writing in his field. But the prospect makes many writers and their representatives extremely nervous, worried that machines will put writers out of a job. Authors Guild has called for legal and policy interventions that balance development of useful AI tools with protection of human authorship. Weisberg, the chief executive of Pushkin, said that while new tools very often displaced people, they also created opportunities. Take journalism, for example. If routine news stories are drafted or generated by technology, he said, you as a journalist, instead of reporting on every fire, can write interesting news stories about AI. March and Pushkin tried to use software to create as much of death of an author as possible, including blurbs and its cover art. But there was one area in which its creators felt the technology was lacking: narration for the audiobook. So they hired a human, Eduardo Ballerini, who has won several awards in the field. But this stuff is moving so fast, Weisberg said. If we were doing it now as opposed to 6 years ago, 6 weeks ago, I think we could get AI narration that would be up to snuff. So, an interesting article, a book that I'm actually very curious to read. If you are too, it's a novella, and it's titled Death of an Author. And like I said, it's by Aidan Marcheen, and read by Eduardo Ballerini. So, very interesting, exciting to see. And I'm curious. I think I've been a little bit, personally, a bit of a skeptic about AI, but it's part of our future, so something maybe to explore and see. All right, so the next article I have for you is about an ongoing exhibit at the McNay Museum in our hometown. And it's about the women who've organized this really interesting new exhibition. And this article is from the San Antonio Current. It's by Brian Rindfuss, and it's titled, An All-Female Team Organized the McNay Art Museum's Era-Spanning Exhibition, Womanish. Womanish, Audacious, Courageous, Willful Art, is an expansive celebration that unites 80 artists and spans a century. Exhibitions drawn from museum collections can be tiresome affairs, at times boastful displays of unrelated objects or themselves reconfigurations that leave viewers with a distinct sense of déjà vu. The McNay Art Museum handily defies those expectations with Womanish, Audacious, Courageous, Willful Art, a powerful and engaging exhibition organized entirely by women. Presented as a second chapter to 2010's Neither Model Nor Muse, Women as Artists, a broad showcase built on the collection of artists and museum founder Marion Kugler McNay, Womanish is an expansive celebration that unites 80 artists and spans a century. Bookended by a 1919 drawing by Laura Knight and a 2022 costume designed by Margaret Mitchell. Rightfully peppered throughout are works by San Antonio artists including Marilyn Lanfear, Leanne Lester, Kelly O'Connor, Antonia Padilla, Katie Pell, Eva Marnego Sanchez, Ethel Shipton, and Liz Ward. As for the show's slightly quirky title, it's borrowed from Pulitzer Prize winning author Alice Walker's In Search of Our Mother's Gardens, Womanist Prose, a 1983 collection exploring womanhood, womanist theory, and unsung heroines. Notably, the collection removes the derogatory connotations of the word womanish and reclaims it as a term of empowerment. During a media preview on March 1st, recently appointed McNay director Matthew McLendon told the crowd that the timing of Womanish opening just after his arrival in San Antonio couldn't have been more ideal. It's such a wonderful entree for me as I get to learn the McNay and learn our collection, to go to these galleries and really understand the long commitment and legacy the McNay has had to supporting women artists and collecting women artists and bringing their voices into our permanent collection, McLendon said. It's been an absolute treat for me, wandering through during the installation, seeing artists that I've long loved and admired, but also seeing a lot of artists that are new to me, particularly San Antonio and Texas artists. I'm thrilled to start learning about them and their important work. Perhaps more importantly, McLendon stressed the collaborative nature in which Womanish came together and congratulated the curatorial team of McNay Assistant Curator Lauren Thompson, Collections Manager Liz Paris, Tobin Theatre Arts Fund Assistant Curator Kim Neptune, and CEMES Foundation intern Paula Contreras. It's a real testament to how museums are trying to work today, which is much more collaboratively within departments, McLendon said. We know that that kind of collaborative working method produces a very strong product when you bring different voices, different perspectives, different visions together in this way. And I think Womanish really shows how strong that collaborative approach can be. Before passing the reins to Lauren Thompson to begin a walkthrough of the Tobin Exhibition Galleries, McNay Head of Curatorial Affairs Renee Paul Barlow, a key figure at the museum since 2005, offered a bit of historical context. From our founding in 1954, we've always championed the work of women artists. We were founded by a woman who collected the work of women artists. As Thompson explained, Womanish is not organized chronologically but by themes that shift from room to room, beginning with depictions of women and finishing with the diverse interpretations of domesticity. In each of the gallery spaces, we really want to encourage our viewers to think about why the works of art are grouped together, Thompson said. Simultaneously alluring and confrontational, self-taught Pittsburgh artist Vanessa German's 2020 assemblage, Black Girl with Snakes, anchors the introductory section, welcoming museum goers with a wealth of imagery and symbols to unpack and interpret. This work of art was created during the height of the COVID-19 pandemic, Thompson continued. Vanessa German also often creates assemblages from objects that she finds within her neighborhood. The theme of this work of art is rebirth and renewal. So you'll see snakes throughout the work. Snakes shed their skin, and so it's this very optimistic look at the post-pandemic future. Commanding attention between works by Fort Worth-based Letitia Huckby and former San Antonio fixture Betty Ward, German's altar-like Black Girl with Snakes is also the McNay's 2023 spotlight. Launched in 2013, that program each year welcomes thousands of students, educators, and families to creatively explore a specific work in the museum's collection. Another early standout is a selection of screen prints viewers may recall from the McNay's vibrant 2012 exhibition, Estampas de la Raza, Contemporary Prints from the Romo Collection. Representing four artists, the arrangement includes El Paso-born Barbara Carrasco's 2002 portrait of labor leader Dolores Huerta and Los Angeles-based Shizu Salamando's snapshots like Poster Girl, a 2000 print that helped inspire the exhibition's bold blue walls. When asked about its subject, a woman sporting a sharp black bob, red lipstick, and retro shades, Thompson explained that Salamando based the print on a photograph she took of a friend waiting in line for Morrissey's autograph. It doesn't get much more San Antonio than that, she said with a laugh. Beyond its thematic construct, Womanish provides an enlightening view of all corners of the McNay's growing collection, which encompasses modern and contemporary art, works on paper, and theater arts, with a keen focus on acquisitions of the last dozen years. Intriguingly, those acquisitions include a fair amount of video works, three of which are featured in Womanish. Held in the Smithsonian's collection and previously shown at the McNay during 2019's Transamerica, Gender Identity Appearance Today, Brooklyn-based Martin Gutierrez's three-minute video Clubbing lays down a groovy 60s soundtrack as the artist dons both masculine and feminine attire, not to mention surrealist eye makeup, and dances with parallel versions of herself. Speaking to New York Magazine in 2017, the trans Latinx artist explained, "My work continues to inform how I see myself or want to be seen. It's the only way I have found to validate my beauty and my expression of gender without being manipulated by social constructs. Expressive movement continues in Kakyung Lee's Dance, 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 a 2011 video that opens a window into the New York-based Korean artist's creative process. Set to esoteric music by sound artist Natasha Diels, the animated short layers 348 dry point prints of a dancing female figure, until the stacked images obscure the foreground into a chaotic jumble of lines. Writing about Dance, Dance, Dance for a University of Maryland exhibition, Nick Duke offered, "Both the process and the cathartic result of this work reflect a pattern of intense study and relief, and suggest the necessity for the meditation and creative action to support mental health." If it's meditation you're after, look no further than nearby Botanic 3, a hypnotic digital animation by Los Angeles-based installation artist Jennifer Steinkamp. Part of a dazzling series that activated a Times Square Jumbotron in 2016, the large-scale work depicts intricately rendered flowers blowing about, colliding and breaking apart against a background as dark as the night sky. In her statement about the looped video, Steinkamp writes, "Plants have a wonderful way of responding to their environment. My work draws our attention to the atmosphere around us. As plants move, they reveal the invisible currents of the air." Beyond the smart selection of artwork, Womanish excels with thought-provoking pairings, deft use of color, and tight geometric arrangements. Conversations emerge between objects, the wall colors, avocado green and the aforementioned deep blue, play exceptionally well with the work, and certain framed pieces are presented in meticulous configurations, at times with no space at all between them. A gleaming highlight of the gallery exploring domestic trappings, late San Antonio artist Katie Pell's lowrider-inspired candy dryer beckons from a corner, accompanied by Perry Schwartz's 2015 Aquatint Bottles and Jars 3 and The Big Suit, an oversized costume Leslie Dill designed for a production dubbed Worst Case Scenario. Agnes Martin's 30-piece print suit on a clear day is hung in a fashion the late grid-obsessed artist would surely approve of. And San Antonio-based Kelly O'Connor's retro-fabulous mixed-media collage Magnetic Fields looks entirely at home on a green wall evocative of a 1960s refrigerator. Further kudos to co-curators Thompson, Paris, Neptune, and Contreras, Womanish is organized in a way that prompts investigation and discovery. Nuances, secrets, and humorous flourishes emerge when considering the placement of works. Situated near the entrance, San Antonio artist Leanne Leister's painted wood and plexiglass duo, Residuum of Variety of Forms Recovering from Transubstantiated Clarity, is hung high in a corner, suggesting her alien-esque organisms could be sprouting from the wall. Speed through the show and you'll miss them, but two mysterious boxes installed in the gallery invite viewers to crouch down and peer through a tiny viewing window. Inside are tiny dioramas, painstakingly created by members of the McNays Education Department, inspired by nearby artworks. In a shining example of the bold creativity that went into curating Womanish, the team split apart the 15 components of Laredo-born San Antonio artist Ethel Shipton's print suit, another 15 minutes, and dispersed them among the galleries. As a result, Shipton's series, which nods to Andy Warhol's iconic quote and aptly celebrates everyday objects, seems to be around every corner. As viewers navigate the space, these scattered puzzles pieces might bring to mind an artsy scavenger hunt, which is exactly the point. As guests arrive, they're invited to pick up a free postcard and check off each Shipton print they find. Those who complete the challenge can report to the front desk and have their postcards stamped in ink. When asked about this interactive component, Thompson replied, "Ethel considers another 15 minutes a playful series, so we decided to have fun with it." So that could be a very interesting, fun way to spend an afternoon. I'm always excited to see what the McNay is doing, and it's very cool to see a female-led, female-centered exhibition that they're showing. It'll be there all the way through July 2nd. So come by, and I think you might enjoy it. Hopefully this got you excited. All right, so our next article is going back in the tech world to New York Times. And I thought this was an interesting article as somebody that wears an Apple Watch, and I'm sure many of you have some kind of smartwatch. For me personally, I started wearing it as a way to track my fitness, which I think is a common reason for a lot of people. And here's an interesting thought about that specific point about tracking data and fitness. All right, so this article, as I mentioned, is from the New York Times. This is by Brian Chen, and it's titled, "What Good Are Wearable Computers If the Data Is Wrong?" Smartwatches from tech companies like Apple and Garmin make it easy to see a number that could reflect how old you are more accurately than your age. The VO2 max, the maximum amount of oxygen that your body can use during intense exercise. The higher your VO2 max, exercise experts say, the better your cardiovascular fitness and potentially the longer your life. In the past, only serious athletes sought a traditional VO2 max test, which involved wearing cumbersome sensors while exercising inside a lab. But now, anyone can get an estimate by wearing a smartwatch and moving around. Is it good to have access to this kind of information? And how accurate could a wearable be? In the last 5 months, when I fell down a VO2 max rabbit hole, I learned some uncomfortable truths about my health and the limits of smartwatches. First, let me tell you about my fitness journey. In November, while I was out celebrating my birthday, my Apple Watch delivered the most unwanted gift, a notification of a high heart rate. That led me to look at my VO2 max, which the Apple Watch said was 32, well below average for a man in his late 30s. In search of a quick solution, I bought a membership at High Intensity Interval Gym, a type of training that specializes in boosting cardio fitness. 5 months and many kettlebell swings and jump squats later, I felt progress. I burned fat, gained muscle, and felt more energetic. The Apple Watch gave me a VO2 max estimate of 40, just shy of average, and a Garmin watch that I also wore rated me at 45. All that was left to do was take a real VO2 max test, so I found one. This is where the good news ends. A few hours after pedaling on an exercise bike with an oxygen mask strapped to my face, I got my lab results. 25, a rating of poor. Far below the flattering results from the Apple Watch and Garmin. Devastating. Dr. Ethan Weiss, a cardiologist in San Francisco who has studied wearable technology for many years, said my experiment underscored the pros and cons of using smartwatch data to explore health. On the one hand, you can give it credit for kicking you in the butt and telling you to go work out, he said. But on the other hand, now you're sort of burned with this real test and like, what do I do with this number? Fortunately, after studying all the data, learning how the wearable algorithms work, and talking with health experts, I arrived at a positive conclusion. Even if the smartwatch numbers were wrong, they were correct in broad strokes, and I was probably better off wearing one than not. My experience can serve as a template for anyone trying to have a healthy relationship with technology tracking many types of health data, from sleep patterns to body fat. A deeper look at the data. Last month, my gym in Oakland, California, called Sweat, announced that it had teamed up with PNOE, a metabolic health lab, to offer clinical-grade VO2 max testing, so I signed up with Gusto. The purpose of a clinical VO2 max test is to measure your maximum oxygen intake at the point that you reach exhaustion. This metric, the ability for a person to breathe in oxygen and produce carbon dioxide during exercise, is a strong indicator of cardiovascular fitness. At Sweat, the gym's owner, Cassie Hecker, strapped an oxygen mask over my face and a heart monitor to my chest. She instructed me to pedal on an exercise bike for about 12 minutes, increasing intensity each minute while her equipment gathered data. After I reached my maximum heart rate of 182 beats per minute and began struggling from exhaustion, the test was done. The test was very different from the way the wearables estimated my VO2 max. The Apple Watch and Garmin study your heart rate and movement while you're walking or running for at least 10 minutes and tally a score. Spokespeople for Apple and Garmin referred to documents describing their methods. To inform their algorithms on how to make these estimates, Apple and Garmin ran studies involving people who were doing a real VO2 max test, as well as other exercises, and studied their heart rates and various metrics. The key word is estimate. The watches aren't actually measuring your oxygen intake and therefore aren't actually measuring your VO2 max. It's at best an imputed VO2 max, Dr. Weiss said. Not only do you not have an oxygen mask, you're not actually exerting yourself to exhaustion. A simple reason that my wearable estimates were so far off from my real VO2 max results is that the way my body works doesn't match the heart rate and oxygen intake patterns of participants in the Apple and Garmin studies. Such is the danger of putting too much trust in algorithms. That left me with no choice but to embrace the hard truth. My VO2 max result in the lab test was very low. But that statistic was only one data point. The report also showed many positives, including a very high metabolic rate and fat burning efficiency and healthy breathing patterns. Taking all this information together, Ms. Hecker said she rated my fitness level average, higher than the Apple Watch's cardio fitness rating of below average. She instructed me to focus on my cardio training, admittedly in the gym classes I pushed myself harder in exercises I enjoyed, like weightlifting, and tended to take it easy on the cardio exercises I found torturous, like burpees. Not doom and gloom. Ignore the numbers and follow the trend. In the end, all the health experts I interviewed agreed that even though the wearable data, much of it flawed, had given me anxiety, I'd reached a net positive. The Apple Watch nudged me to pay closer attention to my health, and as a result, I'm healthier now. The broad trends shown by the wearables were accurate. Months ago, after the pandemic had taken a toll on my body and mind, I was in my worst shape in years. And the watch numbers were low. And now, even though the watch numbers are too high, I do look and feel better, and that's all that really matters. That may be the best way to approach wearables. View them as a directional arrow rather than a precise measuring tool, said Stephen Adams, a sports medicine doctor and personal trainer in Danville, California. Whether you're using devices to measure your progress in losing weight, getting more sleep, or taking more footsteps, what you need to know is whether the numbers are going up or down. But don't take them too seriously, because all sorts of factors could be throwing them off. A loose wrist strap, a faulty sensor, or, as in my case, imperfect algorithms. It's the trend that's important, not the absolute number, because this stuff's not accurate, Dr. Adams said. So a very positive, I think, outlook on the whole thing, and a great thing to keep in mind that sometimes these numbers may not be the most accurate, but it's about the trend and the fact that it's motivating you, which I really appreciate. So something to keep in mind. And I learned something about the VO2 max reading. It's a number I've seen but haven't really understood, so maybe you also learned something new today. So I want to thank you for listening today. You've been listening to Arts and Tech on Owl Radio. You can listen to Owl Radio on our specially tuned radio or by streaming on your computer or smartphone. You may also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at www.owlradio.org. Thank you for listening. This program will be replayed after 9 p.m. this evening. This is Hanukkah Posse saying goodbye from Owl Radio.